welcome to another episode of Football Memories and Moments. This week we're joined by Andy Brassel. Andy is a European football expert. Well, he just knows everything about football. I think it was great to chat to Andy. He was one of the people that we targeted from the very start because he's got a vast knowledge of European football and a real understanding of a lot of what's going on in the game. He stays across a lot of football across the world as well. So it was great to hear that his memory was plain and simple. Goal from John Hartson playing for his beloved Wimbledon. And it was great ultimately to have a chat, I think, what it was about fathers and children. He was talking about how much he loved Wimbledon and how that love came about. And then we obviously had to do European football for his moment. And it was a good chat about what a certain game in European football in a very mad Champions League season did for him. But it was great to chat to Andy, a really lovely man, and I hope that comes across to you as you crack on. So here's the podcast.
My memory is John Hartson's goal for Wimbledon in May 2000, late equaliser against Aston Villa at Selhurst Park, which admittedly is one of the most atmospheric, if not the most atmospheric, stadium in the Premier League at the moment. It never felt that way for Wimbledon, let me assure you. So, of course, because it wasn't our home. But to pick out a moment from there is a strange thing, I suppose, in a way, although there were many great goals scored against Wimbledon at Selhurst Park down the years. Thinking of David Beckham, of course, in 1996 from the halfway line for Manchester United. Tony Yeboah in 1995, I know, which has been covered on another one of your podcasts. I mean, this was not in the class of either of those. This was a very meat and potatoes type goal as Wimbledon were sliding out of the Premiership as it was at the time. 2-1 down to Aston Villa after a pretty ordinary performance. Villa limbering up for the FA Cup final a couple of weeks afterwards. And yeah, an unfit John Hartson thrown on as time ran out to try and snatch something. And he got something. He headed in Neil Ardley, of course, Wimbledon's current manager's corner, to spark, well, I think it's fair to say, pandemonium, to get Wimbledon a point. And at that point, to move Wimbledon out of the bottom three on goal difference. Of course, they went down anyway the following week because Bradford improbably beat Liverpool at Valley Parade and Wimbledon lost at Southampton. But still, that goal really sticks in my memory.
Just to give background to what you are and what your football is, you know, you have a vast knowledge of European football. You know, you're very much one of the current go-to people in terms of it, but your heart is Wimbledon. And just to give us an understanding of why is Wimbledon your club?
Well, because I grew up in Southeast London, actually. Everyone in my school supported Liverpool pretty much, as was normal in the 80s, when you were growing up in the 80s. I didn't want to do that. My mum wouldn't let me go to Millwall. I never really fancied Crystal Palace or Charlton. So I ended up going to Wimbledon because I was always curious. I mean, they were in the second tier when I started to, I suppose, support Wimbledon when I was like 7 or 8 years old. And I wanted to support someone who was different. And I was curious to how a team that whose name was associated with something else, tennis, of course, had got up to the second tier. Of course, I didn't know the top tier, and a long spell at the top tier was just around the corner when I started to take an interest in them. And I was made to wait as well. My dad worked Saturdays when I was 7, 8 years old, so I couldn't go. Then he was out of work for a year, so we definitely couldn't go. But after that, when he got a job when I was 10, almost 11, I got to go the first time, and there was never any doubt. I mean, there was never any doubt in my mind that I would be a Wimbledon supporter anyway. But when I got to my first game, which was 1987 in the school holidays, it was August, against Everton, who were the Division One top flight champions at the time. Alan Cork scored in the first half for Wimbledon, and they conceded a late equaliser to Graham Sharp. But everything about it was incredible. The closeness to the pitch, the rawness of the ground, actually, at Plough Lane, it was something that I clicked with immediately. I went in the club shop with my dad, and they were really short of shirts at the time, but he promised me a shirt, and I remember like breathing in and squeezing into a shirt that was too small for me to say, yeah, it definitely fits, because I so badly wanted one. I think it fitted me for about, well, it didn't really fit me at the time, but it fitted me for about 10 days afterwards. But that was my first football shirt. And yeah, that first season was incredible. It was the season that, the first season that I went regularly was the season that Wimbledon ended up winning the FA Cup at the end. Obviously, I would have celebrated a lot more if I'd realised that it wouldn't be a platform to go on and win the league multiple times.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It would be just... A pinnacle in its own right, but yeah, the feeling never quite went away. I mean, even now, I don't really get to see Wimbledon that much because I'm working a lot of the time, but it kind of feels now like an enormous treat when I go to see Wimbledon. Very much like when I stopped going regularly when I moved away to university when I was 19. I went to Newcastle in the northeast of England, so. I probably only got to see like my first year at university, like maybe 10 games that season. But all of a sudden, rather than it being a regular thing, because you know, like anything you do really regularly, it doesn't quite feel that amazing anymore. You know, it can still feel good, but you know, it never felt like my first couple of games felt. But I started to rediscover that feeling when I was going less regularly because, yeah, it was more of a curio, more something out of the ordinary. I feel that when I get to see Wimbledon now, it feels like a really big event. So it's kind of come full circle, really.
Do you think? I mean, there's a lot of parallels, I think, between yourself and Ian McIntosh when we spoke to Ian in our first ever pod. Is that when you don't have, while it's not exactly the same, I think, for yourself, but while you don't have fathers who have a firm say, or fathers or mothers, you know, parents who don't have a firm say, you know, football club choices tend to be a little bit left wing. For example, you know, my three brothers are all Liverpool fans, but because I became a football fan after our dad had died, I'm an Evertonian, and Ian chose to go to Southend and fell in love with Southend from the start. And do you think that's yourself? Is that because you were kind of in debt? In control of your own destiny for who you were going to support? Is that why you've fallen into being a Wimbledon fan?
Maybe. I mean, I kind of helped my late father rediscover football, really, because much like myself, for a long time, he never had to pay to get into the football, through work, because he was a member of the Royal Scots Guards Band, and he played on the pitch at half-time at Upton Park, and at Wembley a couple of times. So his experiences of going to football were quite worky, always, really. So I suppose I introduced him to being a paying customer because it was my will to go there for the first time and to be partisan to one team, because I know he really admired Brian Clough and he admired the Leeds side of the early 70s, but he'd never really committed to a team. But it was funny, actually. I thought about my relationship, not just with my dad, but the relationship we had through football and the relationship he had with Wimbledon because of me introducing him to it. I think it was last year when Paris Saint-Germain were knocked out of the Champions League by Barcelona in the infamous, if you're Parisian, La Remontada, where they came back and won the second leg 6-1. And I was talking to Julien Laurent, of course, is a Paris Saint-Germain fan, about this. And he said to me that like the worst bit about it was how upset his son was. And yeah, when we were talking about it, it all kind of clicked for me. My dad was always so angry when Wimbledon lost, and it was because he felt they'd let me down, and that made him really annoyed, and that was far worse than any disappointment that he might have felt.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic, because as you say, it's that attachment between the two, and that's unfortunately something I've never experienced. So it is nice to know that that happens. So if we look at the season, I was looking at the side. I'm just having a quick look at the BBC match report from the day, and as an Evertonian, that season was kind of a write-off for us because I remember Kevin Campbell coming in and scoring loads of goals and easing our own relegation fears. But looking at that Wimbledon side on paper, that is a side that should never have gone down. Is that something you'd agree with?
Well, it's funny you should say that, Barry, because you would say player for player is the best set of players to have worn Wimbledon shirts collectively. I think that's clear. There were a couple of problems. One, egos. Two, another thing starting with EG, Egil Olsen, who didn't do a great job as manager, and the club, which were clearly Norwegian owned at that point, and Sam Haman, who was still in charge of the day-to-day running of the club, realised that it wasn't working out far too late. They fired him with two games left. It was an okay start to the season, and then it just all went awry from there. We missed our best player, Michael Hughes, for a big part of the season, and he went off injured again in that game against Aston Villa, which was something that definitely affected the direction of the team. He was the playmaker, and he kind of conducted the orchestra. Probably not an orchestra, probably more an indie band that season from the centre of the pitch. So all those things really, really hurt Wimbledon. But, that was the incredible thing, I think, about this goal, really, that it was a bit of unexpected hope from what had been a total mess, really. And Hartson, in a way, as a player and as a man, is someone I really admire, and I was delighted when he signed for Wimbledon. But he was kind of a totem for the way the club was running that day. You know, they paid a lot of money for him, $7 million, which was by far a club record transfer fee for Wimbledon. And he turned up and he was out of shape. Now that's clearly not totally his fault. Obviously, West Ham had maybe not looked after him that well, and the Wimbledon, having paid $7 million for him, wanted to lean on him quite heavily straight away. But he wasn't fit enough for that to be the case. He had a few injury problems afterwards. He was nearly sold in the March 2000 to Tottenham, and he had a few moves break down because of injury concerns. And so he stayed with us and stayed around long enough to get sent off at Bradford in the game that probably pretty much finished us, when we lost 3-0 in the third from last game of the season, where Hartson had nearly been sent off in the tunnel before the game started for being a bit overexcitable. And yeah, ended up getting sent off, I think, for a dissent in the wake of Bradford's second goal, in which there'd been a handball in the build-up. He came back to score what still remains our last Premiership / Premier League / top flight goal. And the way he sort of bludgeoned it in, I mean, he's one of the best strikers I've ever seen in terms of in the air, he's only, I think, 6'1". He's a touch shorter than me. But in terms of his jump, the sheer power he got on the ball, he was an incredible header of the ball, and when that ball hit the net, you know, when it's a really important goal, you forget all the other stuff, don't you? Like the terrible games that you've had to endure for the rest of the season, everything that's wrong with the team, the fact that the board have mucked it up, all that sort of stuff. And in the melee, one of my best friends, who's ever such a one of the kindest men I know, accidentally punch one of my other best friends in the face really hard. One of my mates was kind of wandering around completely out of it. Now, I didn't realise what had happened. I thought he was absolutely stunned by us getting an equaliser. I mean, we were all stunned. But he was just out of it because he'd basically been knocked out by my other friend.
Well, I love Andy, that you love a footballer so much that you think a John Harton late equaliser can stun an adult human being. In I like that. I'm just trying to work out the order in which to ask this, because I want to finish on the emotional. So we'll actually talk about the game itself. There seems to be something criminal from the match report, is that you seem to, and this might have summed up your season, but you know, I don't want to be heightist here, but the second goal from Villa seemed to be created from, in the words of Paddy McGuinness in Phoenix Nights, how far away are they? Alan Wright and Lee Hendry are involved in the goal. That must have summed your season up.
In many ways, I suppose so. But you know what? All I can really remember about this game is a very fortunate opening goal, which was very much we've scored. What a pleasant surprise sort of moment. The own goal by the late Ugo Ehiog. And just in the middle was just a mulch of mediocrity right up until that Hartson goal. I mean, that's one of the reasons, I guess, it stands out so much. But I know, while we're on the goal and the result and its implications, as I said, it could have saved Wimbledon and didn't, because they didn't get it done the next week at Glen Hoddle Southampton. But I guess there are a couple of reasons I did pick this goal. One, because I remember it so well, and I remember the celebration so well. And, you know, just because it ended up, I suppose, not really counting in the end because it didn't keep us up, it meant something at the time. And I think that's very important. I think, especially when you're talking about memory and memories fading over time, you know, hope is important, even if it's only for a little while, especially when you're a football fan, I think. I think that's one of the most important things. And also how it might have changed Wimbledon's future, really, and the entity that went on to become Milton Keynes Dons. Because I look back at this sometimes and I think, well, you know, what would have happened if we'd have stayed up in the Premiership that season? Because we all know what happened in 2002, when vast majority of Wimbledon fans, with the confirmation of the Milton Keynes move, formed their own club from level nine, came all the way back up, and now it's an extraordinary story, of course. You've got AFC Wimbledon and Milton Keynes in the same division in the third tier. But if the owners, who their plan had clearly been to take Premier League football or Premiership football to Milton Keynes, if they'd have stayed up, how would it have gone? You know, would would there have been so much focus on AFC Wimbledon without the sense that it was going so badly for the club that was formerly Wimbledon? You know, they're questions to which we'll never really know the answers. So I kind of looked back, and obviously I felt sad when we got relegated. Not devastated, but sad when we got relegated. Kind of look back now and wonder, you know, was Wimbledon going down for the best? And I think it probably was, actually, yeah. Because of course we know what happened a couple of seasons after that, and you know that not just the landscape of Wimbledon history, but I think the landscape of Premier League history might look a lot different. You know, who knows, we might even have a Milton Keynes club in the top flight, or might have had a Milton Keynes club in the top flight. We really don't know. And you know, I think the whole contradictory swell of emotions is very important, because of course, like, worse than any defeat, any relegation, was the feeling of having your club taken away from you in 2002. But whereas I'd never wish that on any club, even a club that I dislike intensely. On the other hand, I can't regret anything that's happened since 2002, because the years supporting AFC Wimbledon have surpassed finishing in the top six of the Premier League, beating United or Chelsea, you know, winning at Anfield, winning the FA Cup, any of that sort of stuff is just all small beer to like the moments like getting back in the league when we won the penalty shootout against Luton at the City of Manchester in 2011.
There's an interesting question from my point of view is twofold really. One is predicting the future and two is just predicting what the present could have been. But the return to Plough Lane, which is the end of this fantastic story, you know, first of all, do you think you're going to have the same emotions as a whatever year old going to Plough Lane when it reopens compared to the child? But also, would you have liked to have watched your original Wimbledon back at Plough Lane playing a level of good football?
Well, you know what? We missed Plough Lane from the moment we went. So whatever the logistical problems, it was tough to move to Selhurst Park. I mean, clearly, history tells us that there was no will from the owners to find a way to move back to Wimbledon. And that's been the difference between the last decade and a half of Wimbledon and AFC Wimbledon, which was very much driven by the fans, of course, and had the idea of going back to Wimbledon, which people talked about as a pipe dream, as a genuine objective, and now it's been being made into a reality. I tend to think I will have a lot of similar emotions, not quite the same, of course, but similar emotions going back to Plough Lane. I remember the last game at Plough Lane was we lost 3-0 to Crystal Palace. I was 14 at the time, so this would have been, 1991. And Ian Wright, who I've got to know quite well through work, scored a hat-trick in that, which is totally bizarre. Talking about predicting the future, and you never know how the future will turn out. I mean, that's one of those strange things. It's that last game, I don't think is something I've ever discussed with him, though maybe I should at some point. But that sort of family link as well. I mean, my children are still quite small. They're 6 and 4, but just starting to take an interest in football. They've been to see Wimbledon once or twice. And yeah, I do feel they're going to have to, my sons are going to have to come to Plough Lane with me, even if it's just the once, just to sort of complete the circle, really.
Yeah.
Maybe it will mean a lot more to me than it does to them. I suspect it will. And, you know, that is the thing when we go back to how you started supporting a team. You never have any idea when you start supporting a team as a child what it means, or the fact that you're making a decision with no evidence, with no sense of perspective, that's going to stay with you for the rest of your life. Once you're in, and that is it, isn't it? So, it's funny the way it turns out, and it's funny going and thinking back to how it happened in the beginning. My moment, I think, would be Yaroslav Plasil's goal for Monaco against Deportivo La Coruña in November 2003. It was the sixth in that amazing 8-3 game. It's the year that, well, the season that Monaco got to the final of the Champions League, which it was a strange old season, really, because I just started sort of freelancing and ended up writing a book on that Champions League season. So I was seeing quite a lot of Champions League games for the first time. It's the first time I'd been to Monaco. It was one of the best games I've ever seen. It was absolutely crazy. And of course, Deportivo almost ended up in the final, didn't they? Because they only narrowly went out to Porto in the semis. So, you know, this could have ended up being the final as well. In fact, it was a losing finalist and a losing semi-finalist. But I think the fact that Monaco's hardly a footballing hot by any stretch, but this was, it was one of those games that just lifted you out of yourself. And I guess the reason why Plasil's goal in particular was was one of those. Is I think the way Molina, the Depor goalkeeper, came off his line to clear the danger in the way that any good sweeper keeper would, and then Plasil, a player who I always really liked, even though he never made it at elite level, just bobbed this ball up over his head and over the defender on the line from, I guess, 25, 30 yards. I mean, it was a superb lob. But it was also the fact that it seemed to hang in the air for quite a long time. And when it dropped in, I couldn't believe it. It was a perfect finish. And it was sort of the night in microcosm, really, because, yeah, you felt as the ball was flying up through the air that you were being lifted with it. I can't really describe it, but it was a game that, you know, you came out of the ground and just everyone was just saying, I can't believe that happened. And you so rarely have that. You know, football is a game that people experience collectively, but also very individually. But it just felt that night as if everyone was just in a state of absolute shock. And it was wonderful.
I mean, in the way you've described the goal, and I'm just briefly reading about it here, is it has to be something special to stand out in a game that finishes, now, as you say, a game that finishes 8-3, unless you're Barnet when they first came into the Football League, who used to have mad games like that. 8-3 is not your standard. It's not your standard result. So for that to stand out, but how did you? How did you end up doing that then? How did you end up going? Why were you writing the book to be there? Where did that come from?
Well, I started freelancing, as I said, and I was going to a few Champions League games. I thought, you know what, this would knit really together really well as a book of a season. So basically, I realised with the season having started and with me having done a few games, or, you know, I sort of did clubs as for the book. In the end, I did clubs that were either in the thick of the Champions League, trying to get into it, just falling out of it, and maybe affected by it in a way, perhaps financially, or teams that had a historical connection with it, like I did St Etienne later in the season, of course. They got to the 76th final of the European Cup, and it really defines them still in a lot of ways. And I thought this would work really well as a continuous story, but I have to do it now. And I thought, well, if I think about it too long, it won't get done. So I thought the best way to get it done and get the project moving was to tell everyone I knew that I was writing a book. And then I couldn't back out of it because I'd look immensely stupid if I ended up not doing it. And it ended up being a really good season to do it, of course, because you had two real underdogs getting to the final in Porto and Monaco. Jose Mourinho winning it. The cover of the book was Mourinho kissing the Champions League trophy, or, as many people have pointed out to me since, kissing his own reflection. And it was a really strange, curious season. If I'd have known what it entailed, I probably wouldn't have started the project in the first place. But I think the whole naivety of it, this game kind of captures it in a way. There's no like rhyme or reason to it. It just worked.
It was a fantastic season, and I think actually speaking to Johnny Northcroft about Ranieri and about this was the year that Chelsea really, really should have done it. But it was, and obviously this is the year of the Mourinho. If I remember rightly, it's the year of the Mourinho knee slide, isn't it? At Old Trafford, and it's just. Have you ever known a Champions League season since that's just thrown up so many stories that, you know, you've written a book about the whole season or and the like, but you could write books about a number of different individual stories, couldn't you?
Yeah, probably, and I think of course with Monaco, it feels, I don't know if less remarkable is is the phrase, but maybe less unusual because we're sitting here talking about it now, and it's like not even a year since they were last in the Champions League semi-final, and they had another crazy run with lots of crazy games and an exciting football, and you know, less heralded players come into the fore. But Deportivo La Coruña, who as we speak are second bottom of La Liga, absolutely terrible, and being coached by Clarence Seedorf, who obviously they dealt a bit of Champions League disappointment to in that season. One of the remarkable stories, of course, the comeback at the Riazor in the quarter final. That is one of the things. Depor Moore, I think, make it seem like it's a really long way off. And of course, we're half through again as we speak. The Liverpool Porto tie. It doesn't really matter because there's not going to be any comeback from Porto in the second leg. But you know, the idea of Porto going on to win the European Cup or Champions League just seems absolutely impossible now.
And that's the thing, is that that season was incredible for the reasons that you've pointed out. And what else was the highlight of that Champions League season for you? Because and also it was a time of it's an interesting one now, isn't it? Because that Sky, I think, still had the rights to. Did Sky have the rights then? And so you could watch, and we were able to watch more games, but there was still some famous names like Diego Tristan. I think every football championship manager person would know that. Yeah. You know, you would sign Diego Tristan as soon as you could because he was so good. Does this almost feel like it's football from a different time?
In a way, I suppose it does. I mean, you know, you look down the scorers, and the scorers of a cumulative 5 of the Monaco goals ended up playing for Rangers, which is extraordinary. Lionel Scaloni, who scored for Depor, and Diego Tristan, for that matter, both ended up at West Ham, didn't they? So I suppose it's a sort of testament to how football is changing, is still changing. I suppose it does. It does feel like it's a different time. In that season seemed one of all possibilities, really. You know, you look at Depor knocking out Milan, Porto knocking out Manchester United, Monaco knocking out Real Madrid. For me, that was the standout tie of the whole competition. The way that they came back, having lost the first leg 4-2 in the Bernabeu, and Fernando Morientes' goal right near the end of that to bring it back to 4-2 had the effect on the tie, because of course it meant that they could go on and win on away goals. But you know, Zidane saying to the Monaco players when he was on the way off the field at halftime at Louis II, we're melted. We've got nothing left in the tank. And so it proved to be as Monaco really came back. And, you know, there was such a not just exciting and attractive side, but a very physically strong side as well. And that's how they saw off Real Madrid. So I suppose that is at least a parallel with modern football.
With the stadium, it's an incredible stadium, isn't it? Because it's almost like a multi-story, isn't it? It's got loads of car parking below. And is that beneficial, or can that sometimes hold Monaco back because of where the crowd is? Is that something that they've never been able to use to their advantage, particularly in the Champions League?
Well, it depends if you're talking about specifically the stadium or the location of and situation in Monaco as a whole, because obviously it's not beneficial to have a pitch that has its ups and downs. It's not beneficial to have a situation where your stadium's very rarely full, and it's not a big stadium anyway. On the other hand, it does have elements of natural beauty. I remember being there as an away fan with Lyon, and when you're kept in the ground for 20 minutes at the end, you just look off the back of the away stand and spot the yachts. It's amazing. But on the other hand, for Monaco to have a situation where these players get to live in an extraordinary bubble, really. And loads of other clubs, of course, being a big club with Champions League involvement to the end means a lot of pressure. But in fact, you almost have to create your own pressure speaking to Monaco players. I think I spoke to John Collins when I was writing the book, and he said, you have to say, look, well, we haven't got many fans, but we're going to use that to our advantage. The fact that we feel underdogs, we're going to use to our advantage. And, on the other hand, you think, well, hang on, you are living on the Côte d'Azur and, you're playing in a side with Ali Benabia, Sonny Anderson, some incredible players, and later, of course, Thierry Henry, David Trezeguet, who had involvement in the 98 Champions League run to the semi final. But I think the fact that they have this life where they're extraordinarily well paid, of course, with the tax advantages, but they don't have to be hassled and gawped at. They can just go around Carrefour unmolested because they're pretty much the least famous people on the rock. I think that's a really interesting aspect of it. And when I still go to Monaco fairly often for work, and I remember interviewing Kylian Mbappe last year. And, you think of how young players really thrive at Monaco, especially now. It's really them and Dortmund, I suppose, are the go-to destinations for elite young talent who want to play at the top level and develop. And Mbappe was saying, this is just the perfect situation, really. You can just concentrate on football. There's nothing else. There's no outside hassle. You go up there to the Monaco training ground, which is at a place called, a little village called La Turbie, just outside Monaco. You go up this sort of mountain pass. It's very sort of Italian job. Wouldn't recommend doing it in a coach, certainly. And you get up there and you think, it's not a flash training ground by any stretch of the imagination, but it would be an amazing place to go to work every day. You just look down, see the Med. You've got this huge rock behind you. It's an extraordinary venue for a training ground, but they do feel like sort of cut off in their own little bubble. It is just that you can concentrate on football with any outside nonsense, which I think especially in the modern game is really, really valuable.
And that's the thing, that's why, obviously, you were talking about when Collins was saying that you had to come to that mindset, is that why every now and then they put together a side, because they can click with that one group mindset, because ultimately there's nothing much else they can do in that, and that's why every now and then. But also on the flip side is, when they produce, are Monaco more susceptible to being picked off players-wise than they ever were, or was it just because we're more aware of it now?
I think it's maybe we're more aware of it now, and in a sense, it seems like they're more susceptible to having their players taken away simply because we know about those players more. I mean, the range of football we're able to see, and that we've got our fingertips on our computers and on our TV screens is greater than ever before. It's certainly greater than it was back in November 2003. But then again, you look at that side, I think, from 2003-2004, and it broke up pretty quickly. There are a lot of players who disappeared straight afterwards. They couldn't keep Morientes on loan from Real Madrid. Ludovic Juli went to Barcelona, of course. That side was completely dismantled. And, of course, they were terrible in the Champions League the season after, sort of echoing what happened to them in the group stages of this season's Champions League after getting to the semis last year.
Yeah. But because the super clubs, and particularly PSG and the money that's in the game, it's going to be sort of, whereas they may have come back after 2 or 3 years with the new side, might be a little bit longer this time?
I don't think it will be, because, as I said, Barry, I think Monaco have put down a flag now. Them and Dortmund are teams that young players, top young talent, want to go to. I think you can see the next generation already. I mean, you look at someone like Yuri Tielemans, for example, who wanted to who might have wanted to leap straight from Anderlecht to the Premier League, and maybe even a bottom half Premier League club in seasons past. He's wanted to go to Monaco and play. And I think, you know, you look at other young players who have gone over there and, you know, wanted to like have a go because they feel that they can play at the top level and, you know, maybe give themselves a platform to be plucked away by the absolute elite clubs later on. So I think it's impossible to imagine Monaco having a sustained period of dominance. I think you can't say last season's title win and getting to the semi-finals of the Champions League is a miracle, but it's not that far off. I mean, it's a really tremendous achievement. And because of that, and because of the fact that they've got this reputation for developing players and for blooding them very early, that's something that will help them corner a certain market. You know, not a market that would enable them to rival Paris Saint-Germain or Bayern or Barcelona medium or long term, but they and Dortmund in particular have something else, and I think that's a very, very interesting market to nail.
And the final one for me then, Andy, is that the maddest game you've ever seen?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I struggled to think of anything else off the top of my head. I mean, the first thing that popped into my head was Portugal versus Hungary at last year's, well, not last year's now, is it? 2 years ago, Euro 2016. But that was only mad in context because A, Portugal were expected to breeze it, and B, there were no goals in their games for the rest of the tournament. So that the draw was extraordinary. But yeah, I think this is a pinnacle.